We'll call to order the update meeting on January 10th here for the Transportation Committee, and welcome back, everybody. We have a pretty heavy agenda with a lot of information gathering here for all of us to be well informed on all of the transportation issues that are coming up in the short session, as well as ongoing work that we're doing with our transportation system statewide. And so we do have them listed for you. And we are going to start out with an informational meeting, which I'm opening, okay? And it's going to start with the Portland Area Value Pricing Advisory Committee that's ongoing. And Travis, I believe you're presenting on that one. So welcome. And please give your name for the record.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Travis Brower. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and it's my pleasure today to come to talk to you about how ODOT is implementing the charge of value pricing that was included in HB 2017 from last year. So the problem that this section of HB 2017 is getting at is really the congestion growth that we've seen all across the state, but particularly in the Portland metro region. We've all experienced that congestion. And what we've seen in that from 2013 to 2015, as the population and economy of the metro region grew, the hours of congestion grew by 13.6% in just 2 years. And the total vehicle hours of delay increased by 22.6%. And if any of you have been up there recently, you know it hasn't gotten better since 2015, so it's even gotten a little bit worse. When the Joint Committee was touring the state last year, when the Governor's Transportation Vision Panel was touring the state, I guess it was back in 2016, all across the state, people talked about how this congestion in Portland was crippling business opportunities, making it difficult to get goods from our farms, forests, and factories to markets across the nation and across the world. And so the Joint Committee, in crafting HB 2017, put congestion relief as one of the top priorities in that legislation and created what we call really an all-of-the-above approach to tackling congestion. There's a significant amount of money that goes to bottleneck relief, particularly some targeted investments in the Rose Quarter that are expected to save commuters about 2.5 million hours currently wasted in traffic. There's also additional lanes on I-205 and 217. Beyond just highway widening, though, there's additional resources for public transportation and walking and biking so people can get around without getting in their cars. There's freight rail investments under Connect Oregon that will help move goods by freight rail so that we can get those goods around the state much more easily and less expensively. And then the new innovation really was the direction from the legislature to engage value pricing as a new tool in the toolbox. So what is value pricing? Value pricing is also known as congestion pricing. It is essentially charging a higher price for use of roads at times, particularly the morning and evening rush hour, when there are higher volumes of traffic. The goal is to reduce congestion, improve reliability by encouraging people to travel at less congested times or to travel by other modes or to carpool. This is something that's used in many other industries to essentially make sure that we can use the capacity we have to its maximum benefit. There are really two types of value pricing that have been implemented across the country, including in our sister metro region to the north in the Puget Sound, Seattle-Tacoma area, where they've been very successful in implementing tolling and value pricing. The main type of tolling that we've seen across the country is bridge and highway tolling, where all lanes of a highway are tolled, and so everyone pays a toll, and then the funding is often used as a financing mechanism to pay for replacement of a bridge or pay for widening a highway. The picture you see here is of the SR 520 bridge across Lake Washington in the Puget Sound region, where WashDOT used tolling as a way to finance a new bridge, slightly wider bridge, that offers congestion relief. This is also the type of tolling that we proposed with the I-5 bridge replacement project about 4 years ago, and it has been used across the country as a way to get around. What happens with tolling of all lanes is that some people choose to travel at different times of the day when you have a higher price at those peak hours. Some people choose to carpool. Some people choose to use public transportation. And some people choose not to make a trip. As a result, all the trips across that facility are less congested and more reliable. And people who pay that toll get better value as a result. The other type of value pricing that we've seen implemented across the country are managed toll lanes. This is a type of pricing in which you put a price on just one or two lanes of this freeway in order to provide people who choose to use that lane, they receive a more reliable trip. And the picture I have here is of the I-405 express toll lanes in Bellevue, Washington. This is a facility that was built a few years ago, and they have one to two lanes along that length of that corridor where you can choose to drive in that lane, and you are tolled for the privilege of doing so. I used it one time on the way to visit my parents at Christmas. I had three rather rambunctious kids in the car, and it was the best $3 I have ever spent to be able to blast through that area at highway speeds. That toll lane in the Seattle metro region operates at 90% reliability, so 90% of the time trips are going at 45 miles per hour or above. I think most people in the Portland metro region would kill for that sort of reliability because it's a lot lower for us at this time.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have some concern with the criminal element that he just said, kill and die for, and I am from judiciary.
I'll support my colleague on that. Yeah.
Mr. Thank you very much for your concern, Representative Olson. And I'm quite sure it was just a figure of speech, that he was just trying to make sure you understood how important it had been to him. So please continue.
Thank you, Chair McClain. I will excise all future references to criminal activity from my remarks.
Thank you.
So these managed toll lanes often involve taking an existing carpool lane, which is known as a high-occupancy vehicle lane, and converting it into a high-occupancy toll lane so that people who previously only opened to carpools now becomes open to both carpools and people who are willing to pay that toll. Sometimes it involves widening the highway and adding an additional lane. That's what they did on a section of this corridor. Sometimes it just involves converting that existing lanes. So these are two very different approaches to value pricing. As you can imagine, with bridge and highway tolling, if you're using that to expand the capacity of the highway system, you're going to have more congestion relief. If you're doing managed toll lanes, you're primarily improving reliability for those who choose to pay the toll. It may not have a large congestion relief benefit overall for the transportation system. So getting to the details of HB 2017, in this legislation, the legislature required ODOT, through the Oregon Transportation Commission, really, to develop a proposal to implement value pricing on the I-5 and I-205 corridors and within the Portland metro region from the Columbia River down to the junction of those two highways, and submit that application to the Federal Highway Administration by the end of this year, because the Federal Highway Administration actually has to grant authority to toll on the interstate. The proposal could involve tolling the entirety of the two corridors or segments within those corridors. We recognize that in order to be successful in this effort, we're going to need to show the public the value that value pricing can provide to them with better, more reliable trips and less congestion. And we also realize that success requires a very open, transparent public process that allows for public input so all voices can be heard. To that end, the Oregon Transportation Commission formed a value pricing policy advisory committee to bring these interests to the table and have them represented in that discussion. Two of our commissioners, Sean O'Halloran and Alondo Simpson, chair that group, and we have brought on all the various interests that are listed on this chart. Local governments, the business community, folks who are advocates for low-income residents who might be affected by tolls, the environmental community, and government agencies as well. This group is going to be analyzing how different types of value pricing on different segments of the highway would impact various values that we have, whether that is how the transportation system functions, the community, economic, and environmental impacts, the impact on low-income individuals who may have to pay a toll, the adequacy of transit service, and a variety of other factors. And they will be issuing recommendations to the commission to determine what to put forward to FHWA. The group's met twice so far, and I think Representative Vial has been your loyal representative at all of both of those meetings, and Mr. Brennan has also attended those. They are going to meet four more times through the middle of this year to develop their proposal. They've created a framework of performance measures to review various proposals, and they have approved a set of high-level scenarios that now our consultant that we have hired is analyzing to take a look at the impacts of tolling the corridors with different types of tolling. And they're going to look at the results of that in February. That will really help them narrow down a little bit on maybe some more segments that may be appropriate to look at value pricing. This is going to be a very open process. We have three town halls or open houses that are going to take place later this month. And we have an ongoing public comment opportunity through our website that any member of the public can comment. We give all of those comments to the PAC members, and we also have a public comment period at each of the meetings so that we're ensuring that we're hearing from your constituents and the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington about how they feel about this. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. First question is coming from Representative Evans. Can I make a comment before you ask? I know that we have two committees now. We have two transportation committees. This does relate to House Bill 2017, but there are only two of us that actually sit on both committees. And so this is a conduit for you to be kept up on issues that are going to be affecting not just our bill from last session, but also our overall transportation system in the state of Oregon. And so this is your opportunity to, you know, ask questions, to find out more information, to let your information known and pass that on either to people who are representing you on the other committee or to Patrick or to others that are interested in both committees and both processes. We're trying not to be redundant, but I think that all five of these committees are extremely important in the overall configuration of the actual transportation system in the state of Oregon, and we need to have information about them. So Representative Evans was first, and then Representative Vial.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Travis, I have a question that doesn't probably have an answer for today, but I hope will be part of the conversation. So here we go. One element of the congestion that's occurred, especially in the last 3 years, that I think has not been, at least from what you talked about, baked into a consideration is the loss of T6 and the added impact of trucks on the highway. And something that I'm going to ask this clumsily, but I guess here's the point. What about tolling the Port of Portland for not doing their job?
Chair McClain, Representative Evans, we have the Port of Portland around the table as well as the trucking industry to help inform some of those questions about that trucking activity. I can't really speak much to T6 other than to note that there is some additional service that is going to be started through there. The other thing that we've noted, too, is that most of the service going out of T6 containers involve trucks driving up I-5 to T6. So in that sense, there's probably more trucks going across the interstate bridge up to the Portland or up to the Seattle metro region, but the trips on I-5 are fairly constant. Ideally, the new intermodal facilities that are funded out of HB 2017 will allow some of those containers to get on rail outside of the Portland metro region and not have to take I-5 or I-205. So hopefully there is a little bit of relief for the trucking industry through that.
Follow up to that? Yeah. If I understand it, we're about 6 to 10% of what we used to be at T6 with the more recent arrangement. And it seems to me, at least anecdotally, that there was a proliferation of trucks that would otherwise be using other alternatives or had been going out on ship. And it seems to me that when you were looking at long-term congestion answers, we need to get Port of Portland, whether they're going to actually be functional or look at other alternatives for our major ports. Just part of the conversation. Yeah.
Representative Vial.
The Washington kerfuffle on this seems to be quite easily addressed, and I'm wondering if ODOT has taken a look at answering that concern. The concern, as I understand it, is we don't want Washington folks getting told to pay for Oregon stuff. Mm-hmm. if we do limited lane congestion tolling, what is the anticipated use of that revenue? Would it be to upgrade in the areas that that is being collected, or what is your current thinking?
Chair McLean, Representative Vile, it really depends on the type of tolling application that we're doing, and we're going to be looking at the revenue implications of all these options. When you do the managed toll lanes, where you're tolling only one or two lanes, what we've typically found across the country is most of those are not significant net revenue generators. So in the Seattle metro region, that I-405 lane is actually generating a small surplus that is invested in the corridor. A lot of those, though, basically break even from an operational standpoint. They cover their costs and cover the cost of implementing the toll infrastructure. So that will be one of the things that the Transportation Commission will wrestle with. In general, the principle is that at the federal level and in most of these situations, that revenue is returned to the corridor in which it's generated. And so in that sense, those who pay a toll will get a better, more reliable, less congested trip, and we'll also see the benefits of those investments. So I think we've made progress with our friends from across the river in the sense that as this process has moved forward, they've seen the openness, they've seen the willingness to engage and listen to their concerns. And in fact, just recently, the Regional Transportation Council of Southwest Washington declined to engage on the topic because they recognized that we are working through the concerns that have been brought forward by those from Southwest Washington.
That's encouraging, and as you know, I don't think we're going to solve I-5/205 congestion from the Boone Bridge to the I-5 bridge without a new facility out on the west side. But in the meantime, we really do, I think, need to look at that Washington issue. And your answer is a good answer. It's going to help the folks that are using the facility that they're getting charged for. So thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair McLean. I may have missed this. Forgive me if I did. But when you toll an interstate, does the federal government get a piece of that?
Chairman McLean, Representative Wilson, no. The federal government has to approve that. Yeah. But if you're operating within the strictures, they do not get a piece of the revenue. And that's largely because the federal government has essentially devolved the interstate to the states. We receive some federal funding, but we by no means receive the full amount it takes to maintain and improve the interstate. Hence why we're looking at options like value pricing.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for your presentation. I appreciate it. And you should find all of these slides online. And if you have any other questions about this, please. Patrick, I believe, is using this as one of his research areas as well.
Two-thirds of the way through, Madam
Two-thirds of the way through. I really apologize for not having our new member introduce himself. But you are actually a new member to the committee as of today. And would you please just give us your name and where you're representing?
Representative Daniel Bonham from District 59, the new John Huffman, for lack of a better way of explaining it.
Well, welcome very much, and I believe we're getting you a name tag. Getting a name tag. So thank you.
He's taking
we're glad
place.
You're joining us. Okay, at this time, then, we will go on to item number 2, which is the Statewide Transportation Improvement Fund Rules Advisory Committee. Hello and welcome, Hal.
Thank you.
Please give us your name for the record.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I'm the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'm here to give an update on progress in the rulemaking status of the new statewide improvement fund that was established under House Bill 2017. Just a quick reminder. Section 22 of that bill established a new tax, a new employee tax of 0.1%. Which is dedicated towards public transportation within the state. That tax is estimated to generate, during full collection mode, about $100 million a year for public transportation. And needless to say, that is an absolute game-changing investment in public transportation within this state. Collection is scheduled to begin in July of 2018, and the program is, by statute, supposed to be up and operational by January 2019. Little detail on the funds. Money is to be distributed by formula back to the areas from which it was collected. However, there is a base amount of $100,000 for any qualified entity receiving it. The idea behind that is that there can be some very small counties or tribal recipients who wouldn't generate that much money through the employee tax, but it gives them a guaranteed amount on an annual basis in order to be able to enact transit improvements. So 90% distributed by formula. 5% is a discretionary fund. Really, the intent behind that 5% is to replace the monies that were removed through the Connect Oregon process so that there is a quantity of money that can be made available through a competitive process of some sort for major investments like new fueling facilities or major fleet upgrades or transit centers and the like. There's another 4%. We're calling it the Intercommunity Fund, and the idea is really to incentivize cooperative agreements and schedule improvement, or not just schedule improvements, but improvements of service between transit districts or other service providers. And then finally, 1% of the fund is dedicated for technical resource centers to assist small service providers in planning requirements, technical issues that they may have as they try to increase and expand on services that are available to them. The Oregon Transportation Commission in September authorized us to start our rulemaking process to try to put the details around implementing this new tax and funding opportunity, and also directed us to establish a rule advisory committee. The roster of that committee should have been included in the materials that were presented to this committee. The establishment of that RAC, they have met monthly. In fact, we just had our most recent meeting last night. Charge behind that RAC is really to come up with the accountability measures that go into the administration of the funds. This is not an entitlement program. In order to be able to receive your 90% funds, the qualified entities have to have a plan that's approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission. And really, the RAC is going through the hard work of figuring out what are the principal components of those plans, what's the composition of the local advisory committees that are to be established in order to be able to oversee and provide recommended approval of those plans, working through the details of what are the criteria for the discretionary funds, what are the components that basically, what if a plan is rejected by the OTC, what are appeal processes, all of the myriad details we're working through that process. We expect draft rules to be completed by this spring. We have an April target date, and at that time we'll enter into the formal rulemaking process with the goal of having the Oregon Transportation Commission approve those rules by this fall. That would allow us to enter into agreements in place by the January 2019 time frame. And with that kind of quick overview, I'm happy to accept any questions.
Any questions? This is an ongoing process.
Yes.
And I didn't hear you mention anything about the competitive grant program, did I?
The discretionary funds. I didn't call it a discretionary grant. I refer to it as discretionary fund program.
But that'll be a competitive grant program.
Absolutely.
And you're working on what the sideboards and what the criteria will be to get that out to the different regions.
Absolutely correct. Okay. Absolutely correct. And different issues like regional equity and what are the criteria and all of those components as we move through it.
Any other questions for our presenter? Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you
here
very
today.
Much.
Okay, at this time, we're going to go to our third area, and that will be the 2021-2024 Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. And Paul's going to start us off, it looks like.
It hurts that you'd ask.
I know you troopers. You're tough.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm going to take a few minutes and just walk you through where we are in the development of the 21-24 STIP, or Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. The STIP is our capital improvement program. So if you're looking for a project that ODOT is working on, whether it's a local project that's federally funded or a state-funded project, it'll be in our capital improvement program, or what we call the STIP, Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. Not to be confused with other parts of our budget, shown on this screen here, we have our operating part of our budget, which is our maintenance forces out there plowing snow, filling potholes, and so forth. And then we have the operation of the agency, including the operation of DMV, motor carrier, and so forth. So this is the part of our program that our projects is what we're talking about. And it's the STIP is a federal document. It's required to include all federally funded projects, whether they're on the local system or on the state system. And it's a four-year document that we update every 3 years. When I say we, it's really the Transportation Commission is the one that makes the decision and the approval process. As we work with the commission to start developing this document, we refer back to the various planning documents that the commission has, the Oregon Transportation Plan being the chief of those, and some of the guiding principles that are in there being that we maintain what we have before we expand the transportation system. We also, as we went through this, as you see in this slide, the various outreach effort that we did with the public, it really validated that same value to maintaining what we have before we expand. And if we reflect back on the conversations we had last session and the development of House Bill 2017, that also was confirmed in that process, where the majority of the funding went to maintaining the system rather than expanding the system. It's quite a process to go through and then develop a STIP or a capital program. In June of this last year, the commission approved the current or the 2018-21 STIP, and the next month we turn around and start talking about the development of the next STIP or the 21-24 STIP. In July, we talked to the commission just around the timelines and the framework and the process we're going to go through. August, we spent a little bit of time talking to them about some of the non-highway programs that are in the federal funds, as well as the local programs, the various federal funds that come through us that are either required to go to local governments or that we share through agreements with local governments. In September, we talked about the condition of the system and just the state of the system, the state of our bridges, state of our pavements, and so forth. In October, the commission in their annual retreat brought in local governments as well as area commissions, other advisory committees, and got their input on various scenarios and how to approach this next step. In November and finally in December, the commission gaveled down on the various splits in the program. One of the decisions the commission made was the splits that I show here, the categories that I show here for those splits. The fix it is that maintaining what we have, so it includes our bridge program, pavement program, culverts, those types of things. In the enhanced part of the program is where you'll find projects that expand the system. We have safety projects, we have non-highway projects, local projects, so forth. In December, the commission approved for the 22-24 STIP, $2.4 billion worth of funding during that time frame. And this shows you in those categories from the previous slide where those various fundings went. We put on here, at the request of the commission, House Bill 2017, just to show when we combine the federal funds that we're talking about in this document with the addition of the funds that we anticipate in the same time period in the House Bill 2017, what that looks like. You'll see in here, largely because of the funding in the bill dedicated towards Rose Quarter lands in this four-year period, you'll see a large amount in the enhance. When the House bill gets fully implemented, you'll see much more over a broader time period on the fix-it side than you will the enhance. But because of those bonded projects showing up in this four-year window is why that looks the way it did. Finally, the commission gave us some expectations. While we talk in terms of these different kind of categories or silos of funding, they really wanted us to work with our area commissions, work with our various program managers, and break those down and find ways to leverage different funding. So we're not just out paving a road or just out fixing a bridge. We look for opportunities to combine safety funds, active transportation funds or other enhanced projects and really make wholer projects with communities that really kind of meet multiple needs and be more efficient with the use of our funds. So that's one of the activities that will be happening next. Here's just a brief outline of kind of the steps ahead of us as we start working with our area commissions to identify specific projects, identify leverage opportunities, and finally, in about 2.5 years from now, we'll be at the approval process for this STIP or Transportation Improvement Program. So just, Madam Chair, just a brief outline of kind of where we are at a critical point, but still some work to do ahead of us to get to actual projects.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes, please.
What does the other guy look like?
Yeah.
Everything okay with the hand?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Okay.
You know, Madam Chair, I just find it fascinating to listen to Paul and Travis, too, as he came up here, you know, to talk about what we did last year with House Bill 2017. I mean, this is really encouraging to see how far and advanced they've gotten through this. And there's been an extreme amount of work. I mean, not just from, you know, your agency, but, you know, from a lot of the lobby, too, as well. So I think it's really encouraging to see.
Yeah, I really appreciate that comment, Representative. I also really appreciated the one of the graphics that you had that was, you know, demonstrating what we already had, what we were working on, because there's always a transition, and then also showing what the money and the resources were for the new bill. Because I think, again, we have to, you know, with transportation and big projects like this and a lot of, you know, continued maintenance, you really have to work on, and it never stops, it never ends, and the process is always going on for both fix-it and modernization. But I always enjoy listening to you as well, and the information you brought was exactly what I was hoping for. And for new members as well as people who have been around before, I find it really fascinating to go talk to your region's directors, like Region 1 or Region 2 or Region 3, and find out their take on what we just heard. Because I think it's important for us to hear the full conversation from all sides. And we just heard the state side of what we're doing well and what we have ahead of us. And it's important to make sure that we've got good communication going on with our local representatives and our local directors.
Right.
And also, we've been working really hard to be transparent in ODOT and having websites. So you, on one of the pieces of paper that I read this morning, there was some information, you know, talking about where the public can also weigh in. And as you pointed out, you know, where we have the open houses and where we have the surveys and where they can actually go and look at what we're working on right now and even look at specific projects of eventually for local, you know, city, county, and state. And that's up and going. That's all up and going at this time.
Madam Chair, we're actually in development of that. We have some of that up there, but we're waiting for some more resources to fully implement what we envisioned to comply with House Bill 2017.
Okay, and we've got the state part started, and then we're working with our partners, our cities and our counties, to make sure that the local citizens can also see where that dollar's going and what the projects are out there and how they're happening and how we're doing on our time and our spending of the dollars. So thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to add, to not only talk to our regional managers at ODOT, but also talk to the area commissions.
Yes.
We rely on them a lot for input in local communities, and the chairs of those groups, they put in a lot of hours on transportation, are very knowledgeable, and I would encourage you to engage with them as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Thank you. At this time, we're going to be going on to Connect Oregon, the Permanent Rulemaking Stakeholder Group. We always come up with the best titles. And Eric, I believe, is going to be helping us with that today. And your name for the record, please.
Thanks. Chair McLean, members of the commission, committee, my name is Eric Havig. I am the planning section manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm here to talk about some of the changes to the Connect Oregon program that came out of House Bill 2017. House Bill 2017 essentially created two significant changes to the Connect Oregon program. The first change was actually dedicating money to four projects out of House Bill 2017. The second change is creating two separate parts of the program as we move forward into the future. Those four dedicated projects that were created out of House Bill 2017 include two intermodal facilities, one in the Mid-Willamette Valley and one in the Treasure Valley area near Ontario or Malheur County, as well as expanding rail in the support of Morrow and an expansion of the rail siding in the Rooks area. Since the Connect Oregon program has been around for six cycles, we've never had dedicated or called out projects as part of the legislation for Connect Oregon program. So this created a need for us to update our administrative rules to address those dedicated projects moving forward. The commission modified and updated those Connect Oregon rules, enacted those in October of this past year. So we have some processes to take in those dedicated projects to ensure that we are meeting the requirements and expectations out of House Bill 2017. The main requirement out of House Bill 2017 for us to require get information on is potential bidders for these projects need to come in with a project plan. So we need to create a process for those project plans to be submitted. Another major challenge out of these dedicated projects is that the two intermodal facilities, while they're called out as dedicated projects, we did not have a specific location or a specific entity for those two facilities. And so we actually had to have an opportunity for different interested parties who may want to be in charge of building, constructing, and operating those two intermodal facilities. The process in the Connect Oregon rules established that we needed to have a pre-proposal phase, and we've actually completed that phase within the administrative rules. To date, for those intermodal facilities, we've received six pre-proposals, one for the Treasure Valley area, but we did receive five pre-proposals for the Mid-Willamette Valley area. And we are in process right now to go through those pre-proposals to determine which ones will move forward to develop that project plan. The next step in the process, once those decisions are made by the Transportation Commission, which ones will move forward, we will have a three-tiered review process that's called for in those administrative rules. The three-tiered review process includes hiring a third-party independent consultant that has experience in intermodal facilities, freight, and economics to review those project plans to see which ones have the most viability. We will be pulling together a review committee very similar to what we've used in the past for Connect Oregon. It'll be a very similar final review committee structure to that. And we'll also be looking to the directors of Oregon Business Development Division, as well as the ODOT director, to make recommendations. All those recommendations will go forward to the Transportation Commission to select which ones of these projects would or should move forward for funding for construction. One important note around the Connect Oregon program and these dedicated projects is while we have those four dedicated projects, they come in a little over $60 million, but we only have $30 million of lottery-backed bonds to complete those projects as of now. The remaining funds are anticipated to come from the privilege tax, but we don't know when those funds will be available to make and shore up that shortfall. The second major change to the program is really related to breaking apart the Connect Oregon program into two parts. The first part, or part one, is called for in the House bill, essentially maintains the existing part of the program. It's focused on making improvements to the intermodal facilities and non-highway modes of travel, but it's more focused on the smaller kinds of projects. Part two creates more of a statewide significant part of the program. Part two would only go into effect if we have $75 million or more available for funding and outlets to potential recipients. As we have talked about with those dedicated projects, we'll have to finish those first before we even talk about implementing a grant program for the Part One and Part Two program. In order to establish those requirements for those two parts of the new Connect Oregon program, we will have to enter into additional rulemaking exercises. So we've already done temporary rules, and we're working to make those permanent for those dedicated projects. Once we get through that process, we'll need to start again and start making rules for the Part 1 and Part 2 to clarify which modes are eligible and how those projects will move forward. A couple other minor little changes to the Connect Oregon program to call attention to. The changes in House Bill 2017 eliminated transit as an eligible mode of transportation for Connect Oregon. It also carved out bike ped as a separate carve-out part of the program that will be run a little bit differently than the rest of the Connect Oregon program. And there was a slight change to match requirements for Class 1 railroads, moving that requirement to 50%, where the rest of the recipients would be at 30%. And with that, that is the changes to the Connect Oregon program and rulemaking exercises. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? I did have one. It was one of the last comments that you made on the match. And the match was there some other conversation about that match recently that was brought into the conversation, maybe through the Transportation Commission or?
Representative McLean, I was not part of the conversations that led up to that in the various subcommittee meetings that led to House Bill 2017. So I'm not exactly sure where that match conversation was, but it came through that process.
Okay. The other question that I had was that somebody asked me why we didn't have on our agenda something about the derailment that happened in Washington State with, you know, the terrible crash. And I said we don't really know anything yet. The actual work of investigation has not been done. But one of the things that stuck out to me was the fact that when we start working on things like siting projects or we start working on things that have to do with both freight and with passenger rail, you know, in the state of Oregon, that we should be paying very careful and close attention to what we learned from that accident. And so I want you to know that when there's something to report, we certainly have our ODOT staff and others who are able to bring that to the Transportation Commission or to our committees. But there just wasn't anything to really report yet. It's all still speculation. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our last informational item for today is, for this part of the meeting, is on Safe Routes to School. And we know we've had a Safe Routes to School program, and we also have some additional work being done through our new bill work in 2017. So, Amanda, welcome. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair McLean, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Peets. I'm the Program Implementation and Analysis Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And as Chair McLean referenced, I'll be providing an update on Safe Routes to School infrastructure funding, which is really a landmark investment in Oregon's children. $10 to $15 million per year will be dedicated for efforts including adding sidewalks and bike lanes where none exist, making safe crossings, and adding other safety features that reduce injuries and save lives. Money will be deposited into the Safe Routes to School Fund. That fund is currently governed by administrative rule. That rule was created in 2005 when federal dedicated funding once flowed in. Those federal dollars were used for things like bike racks on school properties, education and enforcement activities. Now that dollars dedicated into the account from House Bill 2017 are from the State Highway Fund, those kinds of uses are no longer eligible. So that's part of the reason that we need to amend the administrative rule. The other reason is to align with other directions set in Section 123 and 124 of House Bill 2017. That direction includes priority to elementary and middle schools, as well as some match requirements. Other specifics are left to the Oregon Transportation Commission. So to initiate that rulemaking process and help to guide the program, the Transportation Commission has formed a rulemaking advisory committee. I think you have a roster of that included in your packet today. It includes members who understand biking and walking safety needs around schools, those who would be responsible for putting projects on the ground, and other important perspectives. That group has met twice and developed guiding principles. Guiding principles are really values and outcomes that the group wants to see that this funding achieves. There's six, and I'll just go over those briefly. The first of which is geographic equity. This was a large topic for the committee. They spent a lot of time particularly voicing concerns with a 40% cash match requirement and wondering if some small and rural jurisdictions can meet that match requirement. So one of the outcomes that they identified is making sure that small and rural areas can compete for funding. The next value was social equity. One might think of the term environmental justice. This is in recognition that there's some areas of the state that are economically depressed, that parents may not be able to afford a car to take their child to school. So the child's only access in those options are for biking and walking. The next is safety, clearly foundational to the program, so recognizing we need to eliminate fatalities and serious injuries, not only by addressing areas where there's currently a problem, but also by being proactive and identifying some high-risk locations so that a child's life doesn't have to be in peril before we put in a project. Health is the next one, which is really more of an outcome. Making investments in biking and walking provides more opportunity to be active to get to school. so that you can achieve healthy outcomes. The final two are really foundational to the program, the first of which is communication, coordination, and collaboration. And really what we recognize is that communities need to be heavily engaged in identifying those needs around their schools. And also, and I think most importantly, there needs to be a close-knit relationship between the school district and the roadway entity, whether that's the state, the city, or the county. The last is maximizing resources. That while $10 to $15 million is a substantial investment, some of these projects may be expensive. And so the more that we can leverage our resources and stretch those dollars, the better. The other thing the committee identified as important is making sure that we get the money out the door and projects built in a timely fashion. So those guiding principles have really helped the committee thus far in their conversations of determining what should go into the rule, what that program looks like, how funding should be shared. The committee meets again next week and will continue this process. We anticipate that a rule will be drafted in the spring. We'll hold at least one public hearing. Once the Transportation Commission has adopted the rule, we plan to go out and talk to the eligible jurisdictions to make sure they're aware of this funding source and how to apply. Then we'll open up a solicitation process towards the end of this year and anticipate funding going out the door in early 2019 in time for the construction season. We plan to monitor projects and the program over time so that we can make adjustments as needed. So that's my broad level overview. I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions for our speaker? I don't know about you, but for myself, this has been one that I've had questions about, especially from school districts. And so I wanted to make sure that we understood what the process was for actually getting information out. Thank you very much for that last comment that you made. And then also that we're really working hard to get these safety type projects done as soon as possible, because there's some families that have been waiting 4 years, 5 years. There has been, you know, accidents already in these spots, and so it's really important for us to be on that work. So thank you so much, and I really appreciate the energy that you're putting into this.
Thank you.
So I'm now closing the informational meeting on those five committees, and so I'm doing that, and then I called one out, and that's because we have an expert, Representative Olson's here and has joined our committee, but I also thought it was a perfect example of something that's ongoing work that was actually in a bill. It was in 2017, and it was the committee discussion on establishing a continuous improvement advisory committee. Now, first of all, that is an interesting, again, goal. And it's also one that I don't know if we've got as defined as we might want it to be, because when you're doing work on something like a transportation project, you put in other items that are going to help with transparency and also making sure that we've got accountability. But it's kind of an ongoing process as well, as we learn from what energy and effort and support we put into things. And so this is being discussed right now at the Transportation Commission. Right. And I really encourage you to go to those meetings once in a while, too, because they're really informative. And when I heard them discuss this, I thought, you know, we gave them this opportunity, but we also gave them a job, and we better make sure we've got both the resources and the abilities for them to utilize this vehicle or this tool. And so you have in front of you Section 10, and again, we sit on this committee. There's a joint transportation committee, and then we have a transportation commission that might want to have more advice, work, or at least support on how they are to do something that we put in the 2017 bill. And I'm just going to bring this to your attention and say this is an ongoing process. Again, you've got Representative Olson that can certainly give us the background on the subcommittee and what they were hoping would happen with this piece of the legislation. But again, it's something that we don't just do once and it's done. It's a continuous process of making sure that we have the transparency and the accountability that we want all of our systems to have. So, Representative Olson, I wanted to offer you an opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So originally, and there's a number of folks from the lobby, too, that was deeply involved with helping me, you know, craft this direction when I got assigned originally last year with the accountability, chairing that accountability group. Where we wanted to go, and there was a different name what we called this originally. you know, but they came up with this, and I call it SEAC now for, okay, I hope everybody gets that. All right. But, you know, the idea is to really kind of pull everything together. And again, it's a mechanism for accountability with ODOT and the OTC. For the public to be able to have a number of issues through this group to always be, it's going to be floating all the time, always working. Kind of you've described that a little bit to a degree, to the point where the public can easily understand potentially down the road of, I was just pulling it up here, what my original PowerPoint was on this thing. Stuff like developing the information that goes into the website that, you know, could potentially the public might be interested in on that mechanism. What STIP projects are out there. And you know, create a ODOT's done a very good job with creating the website they have right now. We're having discussion along the line of wanting to go even bigger with some type of a dashboard as well along this line. But this here, this group is a pretty good group. It really does include a lot of the members that are agency heads within ODOT itself. That was a critical piece that we needed to have because they've got that experience and then some other sources as well in this. And there's going to be a variety of things that they'll be reviewing and then recommending to the OTC and then movement.
So thank you for indulging the chair on putting this on. I mean, it's not like there's work that you have to do. It's just, I think, awareness that this is another area where we can help continually improving our system and being realistic about it because we, you know, you can put a lot of resources to something and we've got to make sure that we've got the kind of things that the public actually wants or kinds of things that the public or even our, you know, our private industry can actually use or that it really does the job that we're asking them to do. So thank you. I appreciate that. So we are now going off of the committee discussion on establishment of a continuous improvement advisory committee, which still makes me laugh every time I read it because of its title. But now we're going to go into the discussion regarding proposed committee legislative concept drafts. And as you know, each committee gets three actual committee bills. And there have been four or five different individuals and groups who have, you know, suggested work. I have discussed with the vice chairs and with others, you know, some of this work as far as what they are. I'm going to ask Patrick at this time as our analyst to bring to your attention that he put out on the dais for everybody.
It's also on OLIS,
for those of you that have your computers here. And you have an opportunity to listen to Patrick give us just a brief summary, but you do not have to rush. Speaking slowly is good.
Sure.
And letting us know what some of the concepts are that are out there that we have some LCs on.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As is the case with all interim committees, House Transportation Policy Committee was allotted three committee legislative concept slots for introduction and for drafting. The three that we have before you, they're all in OLIS as of this morning, and there's a summary also on OLIS, as the chair said, are LC 220. LC 220 is brought by DMV at the Department of Transportation. We actually had a presentation on this in November. Amy Joyce, who's in the back of the room, made a presentation that gave a brief overview that has now been distilled into LC 220. That concept revises the fee structure for documents issued by and services provided by the Driver Motor Vehicle Services Division at ODOT. It directs the department to conduct either a cost of products and services study or an examination of data from the previous two-year period. It requires that every 2 years in order to determine the actual cost of providing products and services as well as an analysis of whether the current fee structure covers that cost of providing those products and services. And then it requires the department to provide results of that study or evaluation to the newly created Joint Committee on Transportation by January 31st of every odd-numbered year, so during the long session, or right before the long session, rather. The measure finally also repeals the requirement. There's a repeal of a statute in there relating to the ombudsman. I'm not sure if that's having any effect other than it's just a repeal of that statute, or if there's actually not an ombudsman, but we have all session to worry about that, Madam Chair. So that's a question that was raised by me when I saw the bill draft today, but we can worry about that when we get to session, Madam Chair. So that's LC 220. LC 222 is the second one. That one, when we originally had it drafted, was coming out as a placeholder. We have since filled that with a place has been filled. The concept that is before you in LC 222 authorizes Multnomah County to utilize county-imposed vehicle registration fees to pay for planning, designing, replacing, acquiring necessary property for engineering, constructing, and replacing bridges over the Willamette River and associated bridge approaches. It applies to fees that take effect prior to October 1st, 2018, and that were imposed for the purpose on one or more applicable bridges already in place. That measure would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment of the February session.
Madam Chair, I have a question about that one. I haven't seen the original documents that created that Multnomah County tax. Was it written broadly enough that taking funds that were originally anticipated to be used for Sellwood and move them over to Burnside sufficiently anticipated by the taxpayers that were affected?
Well, that's why we've got it in front of us, is because there are certain people that believe that that is not true. Justin, do you want to come up? First of all, this is a bill that is going to allow for something of statewide significance to happen, which is to do some planning to make sure that we've got bridges across the Willamette for the entire state to be a beneficiary of. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to figure out how to take something that's worked well on a bridge over the Willamette and how to make it more applicable to a variety of purposes on bridges over the Willamette. But I turn to the expert.
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vial, we can get you those documents.
You need to get
your name. Sorry, for the record, Justin Black from Multnomah County, representing Multnomah County. We can get you the documents on the original vehicle registration fee. At the time, my understanding is that the vehicle registration fee in Multnomah County is written very narrow on the Sellwood Bridge. Through the course of doing the Sellwood Bridge, the bonding expenses were lower than anticipated. So right now, the $19 that is being collected through the vehicle registration fee is very slightly above what we need for it. As Multnomah County looks at the lifespan of all of its bridges and really kind of moving down the line of making sure that we have bridges that are earthquake resilient, and especially the Burnside, and we can come back and do a whole presentation on the importance of the Burnside Bridge and its connection between kind of the east side of the river and the west side of the river and kind of what would happen if the Burnside Bridge falls down. You may have actually seen some of the videos that were put out last year and the year before about if the Burnside Bridge falls down, which is expected during any kind of earthquake, it effectively shuts down I-5 and I-84. So it is really kind of a linchpin to the Metro East-West movement. The hope is that we can use the current VRF. We're not asking to increase the amount on that VRF, but to be able to use some of the excess money we're collecting in that VRF to start the work on the Burnside Bridge, so allow us to do the environmental impact study that's required by the feds and to start the NEPA study.
Madam Chair, you don't have to convince me of the need to make sure our bridges are getting the attention they should, but I'm uncomfortable with the idea that, as you say, we had a very narrowly written bond that assumably was approved by the voters that were affected, and now we're looking at transferring that money to a different project than they voted to do.
Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vial, our VRF was not voted on by the voters. It was done by the county commission. The county commission of Multnomah County at the time was allowed to create a vehicle registration fee. We would go through the same process, so there would be a public process for citizens of Multnomah County to come in and do public testimony. It would be a public process for the county to redo the vehicle registration fee.
So I think the question that he asked, though, is why do we need a state fix?
Why not just let the Multnomah County guys go ahead and do it just like they did before?
So Chair McClain, Vice Chair Vial. So the difference is that when we passed the original vehicle registration fee, it allowed Multnomah County to keep 100% of those dollars. If we were to redo our vehicle registration fee, since then, the legislature has passed language that would require 40% of the monies raised through that vehicle registration fee to be shared with cities in the county. So if we were to redo our vehicle registration fee, we would then forfeit 40% of the money, which is not viable for us to be able to continue to pay for the Selwood. So we've been working with the City of Portland and the City of Gresham to make sure they're comfortable with this move as well. But we want to make sure that this is as smooth and as easy process as possible.
So the answer is that we have done something since they did something, and it impacts what they did.
Yeah, but Selwood came in under budget, and their original action was limited to funding the bond on Selwood.
So I'm going to just interject here as chair that we're here not to debate these bills today, but to simply get information about the bills. I think you've heard the question that Representative Vial had. He was not debating. He was just asking a question.
And we will schedule some time with Vice Chair Vial.
I think that would be a really good idea. Okay, thank you so much.
Madam Chair, the third concept we have is LC 224. That concept is relating to autonomous vehicles. It establishes, just a note, this is the intent of this is to provide the Department of Transportation with the ability to move forward in baby steps with implementing as necessary rules around autonomous vehicles, with the knowledge that they could be inching their way onto Oregon roads in the near future, Madam Chair, and with the knowledge that the future legislative assemblies will be dealing with this issue as we go on. But in this case, LC 224 establishes conditions under which a person is considered to be, quote, operating an autonomous vehicle, unquote, and grants them the same rights and duties as operators of other vehicles where applicable. That establishes conditions under which an operator may lawfully operate an autonomous vehicle on Oregon roads. It specifies financial responsibility obligations to the owner of autonomous vehicles on Oregon roads, commercial autonomous vehicles on Oregon roads, and also directs the Department of Transportation to adopt rules for the operation of autonomous vehicles. This measure would also take effect on the 91st day following sine die, February session, Madam Chair. Those are the three before you. And on that sheet of paper that's on the dais, if you flip that over for your convenience, should the committee decide to do so, you have a motion script for introduction.
I'm going to take your question. I do want to make one comment about this, and that is that, you know, we have an LC there. We're leaving it there. There is a lot of work still being done, and it's a situation where this was to be a common sense, you know, gap filler, because there has been a difference between testing and deployment, and especially commercial deployment, and that's been happening in other states. And myself and others have been to some meetings in Coronado, California in December, and so there was a concern that because of responsibilities that are state, not U.S. transportation, NHTSA responsibility on what is a safe autonomous vehicle, but on our licensing and our abilities to deal with insurance, that we wanted to make sure that we were covered so that there was actually a process or a way for Oregon to go forward if these vehicles end up on our roads. And so that is the attempt that is being made right now with this LC work. There'll be much more in the way of information if we decide to go forward with this bill. And I'm happy to take Representative Evans' question.
Madam Chair, it's less of a question than a comment, but it's not a debate. The process here in the legislature of this august body is to have the opportunity to debate concepts, some of which you may like, some of which you may not like. Today, because of respect for the chair and this body, I'll go along to allow this bill to be discussed with the hope of being able to kill it in a very, very public way once it's an idea, because right now I have enough nightmares dealing with Skynet taking over cyber networks. I can only imagine how much fun our enemies would have, or a hacker in the Ukraine would have, dialing into a 60-mile-an-hour missile driving down the highways with a hostage inside. So I have grave concerns about not just the idea of technology, but our ability to understand and master technology. And I will be supporting this bill for consideration because of the process, but I have grave concerns.
Remember, this is a committee bill. This is not a mayor's bill. And so I appreciate your comment of comment versus debate today. And really and truly, I mean, this process is new to me as well as a chair. And what we're doing today is just putting these in front of the committee for consideration. In a vote today that we might make on a motion that I'm going to ask Representative Meek to do, that, and we will get to it.
Whenever you're ready.
Yes, we will. And that we are not, you are not in any way, shape, or form saying that you approve it, you disapprove of it, you read it, or that you have, you know, really formed what your thoughts are on this. So you are only simply saying that this might be a committee bill that would come and get some work here in this committee because you just are ready to work, right? So that's where we're at.
Right.
Okay, so now I'm going to open a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts, and I'm going to ask for a motion from one of our vice chairs, Representative Meek.
Madam Chair, I move the following legislative concepts, concept drafts, be introduced as committee measures. LC 220, dated January 3rd, 2018. LC 222, dated January 10th, 2018. LC 224, dated January 3rd, 2018.
Thank you, Representative Meek. Representative Meek has moved that the following LC drafts be introduced as committee measures. LC 20, dated 1-3-18, LC 222, dated 1-10-18, and LC 224, dated 1-3-18. So are there any objections?
Madam
yes.
Chair. I will support the motion. However, I want to put on the record that I'm not a fan of committee bills. I've come to recognize that with limited number of bills for each of us to bring, particularly during a short session, which I think is a good idea, having some committee bills allows us to get some work done that perhaps we wouldn't otherwise be able to do with those limited numbers per member. But I think that in the process of adopting legislation, our constituents should know whose idea a particular bill is and just who is responsible for pushing that bill forward. And I think bills that are owned by someone typically do a whole lot better as a result. So while I'm going to support this from that standpoint, I am going to record my objection to the concept of committee bills. Specifically, this autonomous vehicle bill, which we've had a lot of folks work really hard on, and we've got some great ideas in front of us. But that's one that I think Representative Evans's comments really illustrate has some important ramifications, and having ownership of that by folks that are then held responsible for that ownership is important. I will say that autonomous vehicles are here. We're not going to get away from them. They're on the road in Phoenix right now. But I am concerned that until NHTSA tells us what a safe vehicle is, both from the standpoint of how it operates and whether it's safe from a cybersecurity standpoint, we need to be very thoughtful about going forward. Doing some things that allowed us to be ready when that time comes is important, but we do need to be careful.
Okay. I appreciate that. I'm in the middle of a motion, right? And so I don't even know. There's people who definitely have been working on this that are definitely willing to claim credit for and are in the audience. And so, I mean, I think we've explained where each one of these bills have actually come from. And I think that this individual also has talked to some of you, so you know where this bill came from as well. I'm happy to continue on with the finish the vote and then allow, if there, you know, since we allowed the other individual to come up, if you would let me, is that okay?
Oh, I think, Madam Chair, I think if you want Mr. Towers from the trial lawyers to come and explain his thinking on the draft bill. I think that'd be wonderful. I don't know that we're going to go forward with it at this point, but I think it would be instructive for the committee to hear that. So when we've taken the vote, I think that's a good idea.
Okay, so I'm going to ask again, there's one objection to committee bills, but not necessarily this list of three committee bills. So,
Madam Chair, just yes. To clarify,
I will support the motion, okay. So you need not record mine as an objection
all we need
to the motion.
Is a clarification. That's
okay,
right.
So I have no objections on this list of bills being brought in front of this committee at a future time. And now,
a roll call.
Okay, well,
if you don't want one.
Well, would
if
you like
no
to have a roll call vote? Okay. Okay, if you want one, we can have
nope.
one.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
So we will go forward with no objections on this list of bills coming forward as committee bills at this time.
I'll vote down.
Thank you.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes.
All right. So now I'd like to offer Mr. Towers an opportunity to come forward and briefly indicate why we have seen their work on this particular issue.
Isn't that interesting?
Oh, this was a GM bill. What?
Yeah, it's interesting.
So, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Thank you for the privilege of coming to speak before the committee today. I also want to thank Chair McLean and Vice Chair Vile for the good work pulling together the work group that had a number of meetings over the summer, even back into last session, through September of 2017. And we were in agreement with the work group, the consensus of the work group, that 2019 is the right time to tackle this thing because it's there's a lot of moving parts to it. But three words changed our perspective on that. And those three words are deployed in Phoenix, as has been discussed. So we're not cynical about the technology. We're enthusiastic about it, that somewhere in the future, this will be an improvement over the carnage on our roads today. When that time in the future is, I don't know if it's 2018 or 2028, but sometime down the road. Over the course of the work group, Legislative Council issued an analysis that said that it wasn't exactly clear that the passenger-only mode or fully autonomous or level 5 would be legal in Oregon. But there are several sections. They call out 8 sections of the Motor Vehicle Code saying it doesn't make any sense that the statute wouldn't make any sense if there was no one in the driver's seat. And these were major things like what to do at the scene of an accident, what to do, or tailgating was the second one. And then it was also kind of oddball stuff, like you have to be 16 to have a driver's license. And so if you're a 10-year-old corporation, you wouldn't be allowed to have a license. But if you're 16, come on ahead. So what we were struggled with, so with the 17, with the deployment in Phoenix, we thought, you know, this thing is evolving quickly. This issue, this industry is moving fast. But we want to welcome the industry into the state, but still make sure Oregon rules of the road are followed and the rights of motorists and pedestrians and cyclists can be protected. And the goal was to do as little as possible to tide the state over until 2019, when we can have a full debate in session. And so what's the least we can do to get that done? Well, it turns out the least we can do is kill this bill. So that the proposal that we have before you, LC 224, is flawed at the current time. And I'm not optimistic in the least that we can fix it in 6 weeks or 7 weeks or whatever we have. I'm highly skeptical and, you know, probably at the point where I wouldn't recommend it. But we just are concerned that we don't get in a situation where the vehicles are on the road and ODOT does not have the capacity to make sure that the rules of the road in Oregon that are Oregon-specific are enforced. So that's the thinking. But again, we don't think LC 224 in its current form is necessarily completely on track by a large stretch of the imagination. And we look forward to perhaps a work group over the course of 2018 to move forward.
Okay. So with that rounding endorsement of your bill, what I would like to do is indicate that there are still people working on possible amendments that could fix some of these flaws that you are concerned about. And as we know, you know, life goes on as we know it. And so we will try to continue to leave it on the package of possible committee bills. Remember, we said possible committee bills. And we will try to make sure that anything that comes before this committee is cooked and is finished and has, you know, something that somebody can support.
I have a thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question of something that Mr. Towers said, and I a nod from DMV is fine. If I heard you correctly, I want to make sure, because my hearing is not always great. Under current statute, it might be possible, because corporations are, in fact, people, that they would have to wait 16 years before this could happen? Is that right?
Chair McLean, Representative Evans, I think the phrase that was used in the LC opinion was the law is murky on a laundry list of things.
But it could be argued under a murky situation that corporations that are not 16 years old or more could not.
You're talking to the trial lawyers. Sure. Of course it could be argued.
Just want to make sure. Just want to make sure. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we've had our light moment for the meeting, so there we go. Thank you very much for all of you and part of that light moment. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Arthur, appreciate that. Any other questions or comments or anything for the good of the order? We've got a little light there, but... So at this time, then, we have covered the entire agenda, and I believe that we, on this good note, will simply adjourn the meeting. So we are adjourned.
Here it is.